Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Outdoor Adventure Series podcast, where we celebrate individuals and families, businesses, and organizations that seek out and promote the exploration, stewardship, conservation, access, and enjoyment of the outdoors. Drew Youngdyke is our guest today on the Outdoor Adventure Series. Drew is an outdoor enthusiast, conservationist, and National Communications Director for Trout Unlimited. Drew, it's a pleasure to finally have you on the Outdoor Adventure Series podcast. Welcome.
Thank you, Howard. It's a pleasure to be on. Thank you.
Fantastic. And I think we have to do right at the onset is, since you and I are both from Michigan, got to put your hand up and you got to say, where do you live? So here's where I'm at.
So what? I'm not quite sure on the camera if it will be facing the right direction, but I live down here in Ann Arbor currently.
Okay.
I grew up here in Central Lake. And let's see, if you do the other way, we got a cabin over here in the Western Upper Peninsula where I like to spend as much time as possible.
That's fantastic. And I really am envious about the amount of time when you do get to spend it up there, because it's Upper Peninsula is just gorgeous. And I would love just to kind of get back up there and explore. So this is, we talk a little bit about that too. So for our listeners, I met Drew through our membership at the Outdoor Writers Association of America. This is the premier outdoor association, writers association for folks who are just experts in, whether it's in journalism, freelance writing, and anything about the outdoors. And I get the podcast for the and enjoy a lot of great stories from folks like Drew. So let's get into this. So Drew, first off, tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah. I love the Outdoor Writers Association of America, by the way. It's a good group of people. What I really like about it too is it represents a very diverse view of what the outdoors and outdoor recreation is. So I like that it has room for everybody, no matter what you like to do outside. But, you know, that's really where I come from. I grew up doing all sorts of different things outside. When I was old enough, I learned to hunt. My grandpa took me fishing, although I didn't really get into fishing heavily until college. My aunts took me camping. They'd take me camping on Torch Lake or up to the shores of Lake Superior, me and my cousins. And that would just be camping and hiking and learning how to build a campfire. And that cottage up in the Western Upper Peninsula, that we used to go up there for a week every summer. And that was pretty amazing because we learned to fish, even though I wasn't much of a fisherman until later. But we just run around the woods. And we had horses growing up, so we'd ride horses on trail runs and just play in the woods. And I think a lot of that has to do with where my career ended up.
Very good. I love when I hear the story from my guest about how they were introduced to the outdoor space. And while oftentimes I hear the grandfather, the father, the uncle took me hunting, fishing, canoeing, hiking, et cetera. But I have not heard too many where I take that back. There was one where the grandmother was very instrumental in my guest's life, but hearing you share about your aunts and taking you camping, you and your cousin, that had to have been a phenomenal experience just to get out there in the wilds and just commune with nature with nobody else around.
It really was, because it was at that kind of a time in your life when you're very influenced by experiences. I think I was probably 11, 12, 13 years old. I had an older cousin who was a couple years older, younger cousin, couple years younger. My brother's 4 years younger. So we're all within about a 6 year age range. And my aunts, it was before they had their own families and their own kids. So they took us nieces and nephews camping. And it was something they did separately. They'd, you know, they camped, they canoed, they fished. And so they were introducing us to that. My dad didn't fish, but he taught me how to hunt. he didn't really have the patience for sitting in a boat and waiting for a bobber to go down. He was a football coach. There's a whole thing about that.
Yeah.
But my aunts would take us and introduce us to that experience. And it's something that's still very memorable. And I appreciate that. In my family, going back even through old family pictures, going back to the 20s, I've got pictures of my great grandpas holding up fish, but I also have pictures of my great grandmas holding up fish too. So it was always a family thing.
That's very cool. Out here in Nevada, and it's somewhere in, I don't know if it was Death Valley, Mojave, there is a very famous photographer, and I cannot remember her name right off the top of my head, but she and another woman would go out and they would just take photos. And today those photos are just, they're treasures. I mean, what they were able to capture in those moments. And the reason I'm bringing this up, Drew, is I find it fascinating is that we think about are from the male side of the house, the grandfather, the father, the brothers, uncles, et cetera, introducing the kids to the outdoor space. And here, your aunts had to have been the wild aunts, I think, if they hadn't had kids yet. So they're like, okay, guys, we're going to take you out and we're going to introduce you to the good stuff, good experiences.
They're definitely hippies. Yeah.
I can imagine that.
I get that. I get that on both sides of my family. I had some aunts that were kind of hippies, and my dad grew up on a farm and he was a football coach. And I get a little country, a little hippie on both sides of my family.
All right. Fair enough. But I just love the fact that it's not shared enough that women had just as much impact in the outdoor space as the guys did. And I love it. You mentioned your dad being on a farm. How much, when you grew up in northwest Michigan, somewhere up there, were you on a farm? Was this a small town? What was it like?
Yeah, it was a real small town. We grew up in town originally. The farm wasn't in my family anymore by the time I was born, but my dad had grown up on that, and he always wanted me to have those experiences. So for instance, my first jobs were milking cows, baling hay, driving tractor. And I think it had the intended effect. He wanted me to have those jobs as my first experiences to make sure that I studied hard and wanted to go to college. So I had friends who were caddies on golf courses and that kind of thing. And no such luck for me. I was doing the grunt work on farms, and it was enough for me to know that I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life. So I went to college.
All right. Good decision there. And it's not for everybody. Where did you go to college?
I went to Michigan State University, both for undergraduate as well as law school after that.
You went to law school? I didn't know that about you.
Yeah. I went to law school and passed the bar, all that kind of stuff. I never really practiced as a lawyer. Actually, my first job out of law school was working for the Michigan League of Conservation Voters and analyzing Michigan Supreme Court environmental decisions.
Okay.
And that I kind of took the job thinking might lead into a job with an environmental law firm. But as part of that job, I was doing the communications advocacy for the environmental organization. And I found that path appealed to me much more. So I really took my career. That was kind of the forker in the road where I kind of decided I didn't need to be a lawyer and I wanted to go do communications conservation advocacy.
Okay. Had you always had an interest in conservation, stewardship, the land, as some of the decisions you were going to make for undergrad and graduate school, just that interest?
No, I didn't. I think growing up and having those experiences that I mentioned outdoors laid the groundwork for it. Okay. But I didn't have the understanding of conservation at the time. Of course, when you learn to hunt, you go through hunter safety and you learn about the basics about licenses. But I was on a track to become an insurance lawyer, actually. And I decided that wasn't for me. I actually dropped out of law school, went back, finished it up, wrote a law review paper on invasive carp getting into the Great Lakes and the legal strategy to try to prevent that from happening. And that kind of led into that career. But, you know, it was really, I think the first time I really had an understanding of conservation as an adult was when my grandpa used to take me fishing when I was in college. He had moved back. He had lived in Wyoming, had moved back from Wyoming, and to spend time with him on the weekends in the summer, I'd drive. My parents had moved to Gaylord, so I'd drive back over to my hometown and take him out on his boat. He was on oxygen then, so it was tough for him to do that on his own. But we'd fish together and we'd talk. He'd tell me stories about World War II, you name it. But there was one time, one summer, I showed up on his boat and he asked me if I had my fishing license yet. And I kind of blew it off like, oh, no, I forgot. Oh, boy. The one time he ever got mad at me, he read me the riot act. He explained where those fishing license dollars go, how we do our part, how I'm not stepping foot on his boat until we go back into the store and got the fishing license. So I think that was my first sense of how important conservation was to hunting and fishing and being able to do that.
Okay. Do you recall how much that fishing license was?
Oh, geez, maybe it wasn't the money. It was like $11 or something like that, maybe $15. But it was the fact that I didn't do it. And that was part of what you did. And I never forgot that lesson. And I certainly never made that mistake again.
And the reason I had asked the question after you just shared your story is that $11 and then the thousands of others like you who finally bought their fishing license. Really, people don't get how much of an impact that has.
Yeah, it does. It funds the state agency's efforts.
Right.
It also provides match for federal dollars as well. So with fishing license dollars, that provides match for the Dingell-Johnson Act, which was passed in 1950. And it's a matching fund that then excise taxes off of fishing equipment get distributed to states, and it's matched based on those license dollars. So whether it's through hunting, when we buy hunting equipment, it goes into the Pittman-Robertson Fund, and that gets matched to state budgets based on hunting licenses as well. So it really opens up a lot of conservation funding for states, both for aquatic conservation as well as land habitat. But it's the bare minimum of what we do as hunters and anglers to be able to participate in our sports.
Okay. Now, after university, law school, experience with the Conservation League and decided you didn't want to be an insurance attorney, that, again, another very good decision there. What was the next destination on your journey?
Yeah, so I worked for Michigan League of Conservation Voters for a couple of years. That was really good. It was a great introduction to the space and to the environmental issues. Went to work for Michigan United Conservation Clubs for a couple of years. Started an on-the-ground wildlife habitat program with them in partnership with the state DNR that's actually just celebrated its 10th anniversary, I think. Became the editor of their magazine and their kind of public spokesman. And then they're the Michigan affiliate of the National Wildlife Federation. So then I kind of moved up the chain to the national organization after that. Yeah.
Now, had you continued in the communication space and being the voice of the organization?
I did. I was a chief information officer. So it was their public spokesman, as well as the editor of the Michigan Outdoors magazine, which they published at the time. And so when I went to National Wildlife Federation, it was a communications role. Going back actually to my law school days to communicate about the threat that invasive carp posed to the Great Lakes as we were trying to encourage the Army Corps of Engineers to adopt a plan to keep them out, as well as convince Congress to approve and fund that plan.
Now, looking back, how has that effort, what's the status of that today?
Yeah, the communications advocacy side of it has been successful so far. The plan was adopted. It's called the Brandon Road Lock and Dam Strategy. And what they're proposing is rebuilding a lock and dam south of Chicago to prevent invasive carp from coming through that Chicago area waterway system and then getting into Lake Michigan. They approved the plan. Congress approved the plan and funded the plan. And the states of Michigan and Illinois have gotten together and agreed to jointly fund part of the non-federal costs of that as well. So from our point of view, the communication side was trying to build up enough public awareness and support for it that it was kind of a no-brainer for Congress to approve it because it wasn't controversial, because everybody supported it and they weren't going to get dinged for it back home. And so I think we created those conditions working with a lot of partners. I think the communication side is, I look at it as kind of air support for policy. we don't convince necessarily the legislators to do anything from communications alone. What we do is make sure that their constituents are educated about the issue, so that they're hearing from their constituents and they understand that it's the right thing to do, or at least they're not going to get penalized back home if they take that vote for that conservation cause.
It's a great thing when it all comes together and it's working, which is the way it should be. Different constituencies, education, understanding the bigger picture.
It was. Of course, it's mission not accomplished yet. They still have to finish building building the structure, and they have to build it before invasive carp make it through into the Great Lakes. But as far as Congress doing what they need to do and the policy being where it needs to be, that part has been done.
Excellent. Now, you recently started your new role as National Communications Director for Trout Unlimited. What I love about Trout Unlimited, its age and my age are fairly close. I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. Well, tell us about Trout Unlimited.
Sure. Well, it's not the only thing you have in common. Like us, Trout Unlimited was born in Michigan. Yeah. they were born on the banks of the Ausable River in 1959, and really, we continue the ethos that they were founded with, and that was, if you take care of the fish, the fishing will take care of itself. So we're not there to necessarily be the voice of the angler to be able to catch whatever we want to catch. We're there to be the voice of the trout. We're there for the habitat and to make sure that the trout are taken care of, that they have the habitat that they need to thrive. And if we take care of the trout and the salmon and the other aquatic organisms that depend on the same habitat, then the rest will be all right. You'll be able to catch them as long as there's plenty of them there. And so what we do is a lot of the on the ground, in the water, roll up your sleeves, put on your waders work that expands and improves trout and salmon habitat. We remove dams. We replace culverts, which seem kind of mundane maybe. You think about that little round culvert where a road crosses over a stream. But if that culvert is too small, if it's perched, which means that it's above the level of the stream bank, then trout can't get up into it. They can't access all that stream above that in the system in those cold, cool headwaters. And so when we replace that, we open up that headwater habitat. So we can, by replacing, for instance, one culvert on a county road that prevents aquatic organism passage, we can open up miles and miles of habitat for aquatic organisms, including trout. That's becoming increasingly important as we deal with climate change, because what happens with climate change, of course, it's wilder swings in weather. It means more extreme rain and flood events. Those smaller culverts, those dams block that water. They can then get overrun with those more extreme rain events. What also happens is the downstream runs, and where it's backed up tends to warm up more. Trout need well-oxygenated, cool water. And so when you open up those aquatic organism passages, you take out small dams, you replace culverts with bridges. Not only do you allow trout to get up into those cooler headstream reaches that help them survive hotter summers and warmer waters, but you also allow that floodwater to dissipate. You open it up to kind of gentler stream banks. You might do riparian habitat so that that floodwater can space out without rushing down. And so you're doing flood mitigation and climate mitigation at the exact same time that you're improving habitat. And you do that all by rolling up your sleeves and taking out dams, taking out culverts. So it has a lot of benefits that you often don't think of maybe as conservation work. It's really infrastructure. It's funded by infrastructure funding often, but it's the essential work to make sure that trout and salmon can survive into the coming decades.
I love this story. I mean, it in some ways it gives me hope that we are doing things not only to protect the species, the fish, salmon, trout, we're also addressing the climate needs and the challenges to come up with solutions that will work, and to protect the habitat itself as well. As far as Trout Unlimited is in this picture, are these members, is it part of your membership? Are there other organizations, both nonprofit like Trotter Limited, as well as local and state government entities?
Yeah, pretty much every project we do has multiple partners. And sometimes we're the primary organizer. Sometimes it might be the state agency. Like, for instance, the Michigan DNR might be the primary organizer. And our scientists will be consultants on how to make sure that's best done best for trout. You can't do any of these projects alone. For instance, I was just up interviewing some of our scientists and some of our partners on some projects that we're doing for up in the Coaster Brook Trout region of the Upper Peninsula. It's looking at how to replace a culvert that's on tribal land. So on that particular project, we're partnering with the Keweenaw Bay Indian community. We're partnering with the County Road Commission to make sure that it's done right. We're partnering with the federal agencies, NOAA, that provided the funding. We're partnering with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We're partnering with, for instance, on that one, scientists and researchers out of Michigan Tech that have been researching coasters. And we have people for Trout Unlimited whose job is to organize that project and pull all those partners together to make sure that the grant applications go in time, that the deliverables are met, that the contracts are signed, that the contractors that might be, for instance, running a bulldozer are hired and competent, and that work gets done. So a lot of what we do at Trout Unlimited is we're the intervener and the organizer, and we have the scientists, we have the people who do the grants, and we make sure that these on the ground projects get done.
I love, as you've described this is truly a team effort. And as you had said, in this one instance, it's Trout Unlimited taking the lead. In another instance, it could be another one of your peer organizations who have a similar interest in this outcome. How does that make you feel to be involved with these initiatives that really are going to have an impact, not only today for the species, the habitat? And also, I mean, I know you're a father. You got a young son, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But having this special place, these special places there 20, 30 years from now, when your son is taking, hopefully, his child out to enjoy it, how's that make you feel?
I'm optimistic. And the reason that I'm optimistic is the scale of these projects that are happening across the country. The Bipartisan Infrastructure Act of 2021 has invested a tremendous amount of money into infrastructure projects, of course, across the country, but very specifically, the type of infrastructure projects that Trout Unlimited does through a $40 million contract with the Forest Service, with contracts with NOAA. And what it allows us to do is scale these projects so that we're not just doing one county road crossing in this county, but we're doing hundreds of them or participating in hundreds of them all across the country. And so it makes me optimistic, because while there's things about climate change that we have little ability to control on our own as an organization, what we can do is make sure that communities and the trout and salmon that we like to fish for can adapt to some of those changes. And so that in 40 or 50 years, when my son is my age, actually I had him when I was 39, he can fish streams that without this work, he wouldn't be able to. And not just him, but really everybody of his generation. If he has kids, their kids down the line. That's what this work is about. It's why it's kind of never done, because we don't know if we're going to be successful until long after we're gone.
Very good. No, I appreciate that answer. I am curious. I live in Las Vegas. I love going out to the desert. Is Trout Unlimited? I mean, I imagine if we go up to northern Nevada, Reno, Tahoe, the lot more vibrant streams and fishing opportunities. Our organization, like Trout Unlimited, is there presence in all of the states? Can I go on the website and find a local chapter? By the way, I've never been fishing before. That's another opportunistic thought that's going through my head. I might have some folks to go out and they'll teach me how to fish. So, but to my question, are you guys in all the states or presence?
I, Yeah, we have chapters all over the country. Of course, our staff is primarily located where the trout are,
right?
Because they're on the ground doing that work. But we have chapters all over the country. We have a really active, for instance, chapter in Texas that raises a lot of funding for some of the projects and the work that we do in other places, because they like to go out and fish those places too. Mm-hmm. Not there's a whole lot of native trout there. So we have chapters all over the country, no matter where you're from. And whether or not it's even trout that's your primary species that you like to fish for, I like to catch pike. I like to catch bass. I like to catch bluegills. Pike are, frankly, my favorite ones to fish for, but we don't really need a pike unlimited right now. We need a trout unlimited, but because it has these benefits of cold water streams, of habitat, of flood resilience, of clean water downstream. So whether or not you fish for trout up in the headwaters, when we're doing these projects that help make sure that that water is clean and flowing clear and isn't getting stagnant, that helps the downstream communities as well that are downstream from that water. And when we do things like Clean Water Act defense, we're not just doing that for the headwaters where I like to blue line for native brook trout. We're also doing it for the waters that we drink that are downstream.
Okay. So let's shift gears just a little bit. You talked a little bit about the various kinds of fish. And I know from the Instagram account, you have a little bit of a hobby there. And I would imagine as a fisherman and angler, you can never have too many flies. But I understand that's a bit of a hobby for you.
Yeah, I took up fly tying actually during the pandemic. And part of it, I think it was in my mind to do it before that anyways. I fly fish, so I lose a lot of flies. And nobody ever really takes up fly fishing because they're going to save money at it. But to me, it adds another dimension to the sport. So what I like to do is tie up flies, and all winter I'm tying flies, and I'm thinking about the experience that I might have with that fly. I think about the way it's going to swim in the water, the materials that I'm tying into it and how they'll react, how that might trigger a fish to take it. And then when you go out when it's time to fish and you fish that fly and you catch a fish on it and it's just the way that you imagined it, There's a completion to the process there that really just enhances the activity itself. And by the way, since you said that you haven't been fishing before, look, we're both members of the Outdoor Writers Association. Come to the conference. We'll go fishing. That's pretty easy.
Well, I tell you, I'm going to be going down to Gulf Shores this September. So yep. I'm going to take, let me put it this way. Somebody is going to take me up on my lifelong neglect of having never been fishing. So I love that. I love that.
Yeah. I'm gonna show you something else to okay. Here. This is one of the flies that I tie for pike. And okay. And if you're listening to this, this is a pike bunny. It's a rabbit strip. And what it has is tungsten dumbbell eyes mm-hmm. to help give it a jigging action. Mm-hmm. That's part of the reason that I started tying flies though as well, is I'm a firm believer in using non-lead both in the flies that I use as well as in the ammunition when I hunt, because lead can poison eagles. It can poison loons. We have both of those up at the cottage, up in the Upper Peninsula. But by tying my own flies, I can ensure that every fly that I have is completely non-lead. Because if I buy it from a store, I can't guarantee that if it's tied with dumbbell eyes, that those aren't lead dumbbell eyes. But if I'm tying it in, there's not a piece of lead in my fly tying equipment. I know exactly what goes into those flies.
Well, you know, and I was going to ask you the connection between your interest as a recreational fisherman, of the hobbyist, tying flies. Well, it's not even a hobby because you're going to use those, but you also made the connection of the why it's important, because you are, as you create these flies, you're fueling your interest, but you're also ensuring that the impact of this work is not going to have a negative impact on the stream, the consumption, when the lead, moving from lead to tungsten. So I love that connection. Any other connections between this recreational interest of yours and your work that you'd like to share?
Certainly. So when I mentioned that buying a fishing license is the bare minimum that a hunter and angler can do to participate in our sport, I mean that. When I take actions like that, like making sure that I use non-lead, There's no law in Michigan, at least, that says that I have to do that. It's a voluntary action that I take, because when we're out there, we have an impact. If I lose a fly and it has lead and a loon picks that up and that loon gets poisoned, that's on me. I could have avoided that. When I join an organization like Trout Unlimited, or Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, which I'm also a member of, for instance, there's no law that says I have to do that in order to go fishing. I'm doing that because I consider myself a conservationist. And to me, that's part of giving back to be able to participate in the sport that we do. Trout Unlimited does those projects. BHA advocates for public land. Whatever you do in the outdoors, there's probably a corresponding nonprofit organization that helps take care of the conservation side of that activity. I actually learned to surf a couple of years ago, so I joined the Surf Rider Foundation because I felt like that was my responsibility. So to me, that's part of it. If you go out and you enjoy the outdoors, even if you're not hunting and fishing where you're not required to buy a license, if you like to go out and hike and enjoy the public lands, you might want to join Backcountry Hunters and Anglers anyways, because they're protecting the public lands that you're hiking on. If you enjoy clean water downstream, you might want to join Trout Unlimited anyways, because they're the ones taking care of those headwater streams and helping to fight for the Clean Water Act to make sure that it stays clean. So to me, that's that connection between outdoor recreation and conservation. It's volunteering for organizations, if you have the time. If you don't have the time, at least just the membership dues, and thinking about the individual actions that you can take out there using non-lead. It might be carrying a little net bag with you so you can pick up trash along the trailhead, or I keep one in my canoe, for instance. So if I see a beer can floating in the river while I'm fishing, I can put it in there and clean it up. You don't have to do those things by law. But they're things that help make it better for everybody and help make the outdoors that we all enjoy better for our kids as they come out there as well.
And that's a great habit to build, so it becomes more than a habit, but it's a natural thing to do, to pick up the trash, to participate, to be active in the environments that you have a passion for. And I love that. Now, you're a little guy that you share photos with him. I know he had this big bluegill. I mean, look big next to him, this bluegill in his hand. But what's it been like taking him out and introducing him to the sport?
It's become my reason for doing it. Before I had him, I just enjoyed doing it. Introducing him to it has given me great joy, both for the smile that it puts on his face, as well as the tradition that it continues. I mentioned that my dad didn't fish, but my grandpa did. My great-grandpa did. And I know my family going back to the Finnish side, at least back in Finland, for probably thousands of years, probably all participated in that. It means a lot to me for him to continue that tradition at least one more generation. And frankly, it's a fun time to spend with him. I love teaching him things. I love teaching him about, I let him pick out the fly, for instance. And by the way, even when he fishes on flies. He casts them off as Zebco, and I put a little bobber in there to give it the weight. But he's catching them on flies. And part of that, though, is because I tie them and I actually know what flies to catch them on. I couldn't even tell you what bait to catch them on because I'm a fly angler. But it's good. It's a fun time with him. And I hope that he continues it, because, of course, I have visions of us being able to do that as I grow older and he grows older. I'm sure there'll be times when he finds other interests. But it's just a fun time that we can spend together.
I love it. This is a good time for me to be the opportunistic podcaster. On our webpage, we would love to create some collages. So if there are some photos, perhaps you and your son fishing, or it's up to you. I want this to be safe for whatever you share. But some examples of you, your son, family enjoying the great outdoors, that we can kind of put some photos up on our show notes. That would be great if you're open to doing that.
Yeah, sure. There's certain ones that I have permission to share publicly. I check those with my wife beforehand. Obviously, we try to keep some things private.
But, of course.
I think it's important, though, for people to understand some of what goes into taking a kid fishing.
Yeah.
You know, for instance, I've written about it. So there's a certain amount that I'm publicly willing to share. Obviously there's things that I've talked about on this podcast,
right?
But when you take a kid fishing there's, it's just different. When I go fishing, I'll go fishing all day. I'm pretty hardcore, no matter what the weather. With him, the moment he says we're ready to go home, we go home. I want to make sure that's a positive experience for him.
Right.
And I think that when we share images like that, it's important that we also make sure that we share the context as well.
Besides your homemade flies, what is your two or three must-have pieces of equipment that you're going to take out with you?
Yeah, it depends on the species, but my favorite thing, for instance, for fly fishing for northern pike, obviously you have your fly rod, your reel. With northern pike, I make sure that I have a leader. That's usually a titanium wire leader. They have pretty sharp teeth, so you make sure that that's my connection to my fly so that they don't bite it off. I make sure I have forceps and that I can remove the hook. Now, because I'm using a wire leader with pike, I'm not worried about nippers, for instance, for cutting line is much, if you're saying just two or three things. But now let's say that I'm going blue lining for brook trout. Blue lining means that you just kind of pick a little blue line. Usually it's a small headwater stream or creek on the map, and you just kind of follow it and see if you can find any fish on it. For that, it's pretty simple. It's my four weight rod and reel, obviously a small fly box with some basic flies. But I want to make sure that I have forceps to safely remove a hook and pinch down the barbs. Landing net depends on where you are, if you need it, as well as nippers for pulling that off. I think fly fishing is something that can get really complicated if you make it really complicated, but it can also be done very simply. So you can have just three or four items on you in addition to your fly box and your rod and reel and have a fun time out there fishing. And you don't necessarily have to buy all the gadgets. The gadgets are fun. when you're a gear junkie, it's fun to test out new things. But I think the barrier to fly fishing often is perception rather than reality. It's something you can get into really simply and frankly not much money, especially if you're going to start with something like panfish. You don't need an expensive rod, don't need an expensive reel, a little basic supply of flies, some nippers and some leaders to do your line and a landing net. And that's about it. And it doesn't cost too much when you start that way to learn. So I think people can get into fly fishing a lot easier than maybe they perceive.
Okay. No, I appreciate you sharing that. Before we head to the final stretch of the episode, let's talk a little bit about the Outdoor Writers Association of America. When did you join?
Oh, I think that was 2017.
Okay.
It wasn't very long ago. It was not too long after I came to work for the National Wildlife Federation. I had been already a member of the Michigan Outdoor Writers Association, as well as the Association of Great Lakes Outdoors Writers, which I still am. I'm also on the board of the Michigan Outdoor Writers Association. But I think when I came to work for the National Wildlife Federation, my communications responsibilities now extended beyond the borders of Michigan. I was responsible at first for Great Lakes, and one of my roles with National Wildlife Federation while I was there is I got promoted to the manager of National Sporting Communications. With those national communications responsibilities, I sought out the Outdoor Writers Association of America to build those connections. I looked at it at first from the networking standpoint. Look, there's issues that we were advocating for that I wanted to get in front of a nationwide group of outdoor writers that I would hope would write about it. When I got to the first conference there, I think that was in Fort Wayne then, I met the folks. I met folks like Ken Keffer and Katie McCaleb, and it just really enjoyed talking with them. I really enjoyed their perspectives. I learned more about the Outdoor Writers Association of America and the way that it was moving into the future. I come from that traditional hunting and fishing background, and that's really what OWA was for decades and decades and decades, and it still is. We haven't changed or gone away from that. What we've done is add to that. And the way that we started this conversation, my aunts never took me hunting and fishing. My aunts took me camping, backpacking, hiking, we now encompass that as well at Outdoor Writers of America, Association of America. And I think that's important because even those of us who hunt and fish do other things as well. I surf, I trail run, I backpack, I camp, I canoe, I kayak. I do all those things as well as hunt and fish. And the Outdoor Writers Association of America has room for recognizing and encouraging and improving the craft of people writing about all those subjects and more. And I think that's what I really like about the organization.
I appreciate that. And I would, a lot of your sentiment when I first joined is actually as a result of moving from Chicago to Las Vegas for a work project and wanting to go car camping and deciding, wow, there's a whole subculture of folks that are actively in the outdoor space. And a friend of mine had recommended, you should join the OWAA. And my perception was that's a good networking opportunity, but it was also a good podcasting opportunity. And now that podcast, the Outdoor Writers, the Outdoor Adventure Series, is now growing much faster than my business podcast. So, and I get to have conversations with folks like you. So it's a win-win.
I used to do that too. I used to host the National Wildlife Federation Outdoors podcast.
Yeah.
And so when I'd go to the Outdoor Writers Association of America conferences, I'd bring my recording equipment and I'd sit down with Johnny Carroll Sane, with Chris Milgate, and I'd get as many interviews as I could when I was there. Yeah. Because there's subject matter experts in such a wide range of activities. It's pretty impressive.
Oh, most definitely. Before we head out, Drew, we have a couple segments on our show that one is called the Aha Moment, where we kind of ask our guest kind of to take a view back to their career and how they got started in the space, the outdoor space. And I mean, you literally could go all the way back to your grandfather and to your aunts, but thinking about your career and what you're doing now and the impact that the work that you're doing is having, what would be your aha moment that you'd like to share with our listeners about the journey you've been on?
Yeah, I don't know that I've had an aha moment on success, because conservation is not something that you get to stop and say, hey, we did it, we're done. Look, I've been part of advocating for a lot of bills that have been passed. I was part of the National Wildlife Federation team that, along with many organizations and a whole lot of other advocates, help get, for instance, the Land and Water Conservation Fund permanently reauthorized and funded. But as soon as that bill got signed, boy, there was another thing that was a threat that we had to go to and work on. When I think about the work that Trout Unlimited is doing right now, we're taking out culverts and bridges that were built over the course of often anywhere from 50 to 100 years ago. So we're still just mitigating the mistakes of the past. That doesn't even get into the proactive things that we're doing to the future. Although a lot of times we're, as I mentioned, we're helping prepare for the future by taking out those mistakes of the past. But there's so many of them. No matter how many small dams and culverts you take out, there's a whole lot more that are impeding trout habitat somewhere that need to be taken out. There's always more work to do. Every time you pass a bill, there's another bill that maybe is coming down the line that you need to argue against, because that would undo the work that you just did. There's never a moment where you can sit back and say mission accomplished with conservation. But what it does is it provides a lifetime of something worth doing. It provides a lifetime, a career's worth of something worth putting your shoulder into every day and working hard to advance it whatever inch you can that day.
Fantastic. Well, I appreciate that. And what you have shared throughout this episode and kind of bringing it home today is there's hope. As long as we are committed and we stick with it and we perhaps look at not just how do we solve this issue, but what's the system that's running and the issue behind that and after that to create a future for not only, like you said earlier, just your son, but your son's kids in the near future. That's our opportunity.
Yeah. And it comes down to, so I'm part of my heritage is Finnish.
Yeah.
And really what that comes down to is a concept that they have of Sisu.
Okay.
And what that is kind of the dogged determination, steady determination, steady stubbornness in the face of whatever obstacles may arise. And if you think about, you know, a culture that developed in the landscape, in the conditions that it developed in, it means that you don't stop and complain about it. It means that you just keep chipping away at it. And so when I talked about the work of conservation, if you lose a bill, if a bill gets passed that weakens protections, you don't give up. You just keep chipping away at it. We just celebrated sort of some victories for Bristol Bay. That was decades in the making. And it's still not completely a settled thing, but it's a pretty good deal that they're not going to develop there. Well, that took a lot of sisu, because that was over decades. They just kept slugging away at it. And that's what conservation work is. And it's something that I learned growing up, something that I learned through, you know, playing football for my dad, frankly. But it's something that I bring to work and that I see in the conservation work of both TU and a lot of our partners. Getting the Land Water Conservation Fund fully funded, that was a 50-year effort. That it's not something that when we didn't get a bill passed, we gave up. We just kept slugging away at it till we got it done. So that's sisu. That's what I think embodies conservation work more than probably any other word.
I love it. Drew, before we head out, if our listeners would like to learn more about the work that you're doing with Trout Unlimited, where are the best places for them to go?
Yeah, the website, www.tu.org. It has a place where if you want to learn about the conservation work that we're doing, we have a section on trout media with blogs that are updated multiple times a week that just has examples of the type of work that we do, the culverts that we take out, the bills like the Clean Water Act that we're trying to pass, a Good Samaritan Act that would help us clean up abandoned mines without the legal liability. That would prevent it from being cleaned up. So there's lots of good things that we're doing. And if you like what we're doing, it's a place where you can join as well.
Yeah. And for our listeners, as an individual, I mean, it was like $25. I think that's what it was. It's like nothing. That's a couple fancy coffees at Starbucks, I think.
Yeah. I'm a member of several conservation organizations. And what I think is it's something that allows me to be part of that work. Right. It's an investment in that work. And if I like to go out on trout streams or even fish on a bluegill pond, by making that membership part of what I do, I feel like I've now done my part where I deserve that fish that I caught.
And as I have been interviewing guests on the podcast, so yourself with Trout Unlimited, Katie McKilla, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, the Isaac Walton League, all great organizations. And I think collectively you can, from my perspective, it's a great way to hear about what people are doing in their communities. Because from my perspective, it's all about the story. What are the local stories and how are people making a difference locally? And it's a great way to kind of share that. So I think you're spot on.
And we each of our organizations has our piece of conservation that we focus in. I think if you add us all together, though, we're getting a pretty big slice of that whole chunk.
Most definitely. Well, Drew, I appreciate you taking the time to join us on the Outdoor Adventure Series. It's probably been trying to do this for a while now, but this being able to follow you on the social sites, I appreciate you friending me. And also I get to follow you on Instagram. So it's been great to kind of see your progress, and it's actually see the smile on your son's face when he had that bluegill in his hand. It's like, oh my gosh. But I just really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day, and I can see you're in the man cave now. It's where all the big stuff happened. And listen, we wish you much success, and I look forward to seeing you down in Gulf Shores this coming fall at the OWAA conference.
Thank you, Howard. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Listen, stay in the line. We're going to do a quick close and you and I can have a final chat. Okay. All right. Okay, folks, we have just been chatting with Drew Youngdyke, outdoor enthusiast, conservationist, and national communications director for Trout Unlimited. What a great episode. Learning so much about Drew's entry into the outdoor space. If you want to find out more about Trout Unlimited, do visit their website at tu.org, and we'll provide the backlinks to it as well as some of the media that Trout Unlimited is producing. Do consider also of becoming a member of Trout Unlimited, or if you're an organization that collectively wants to make a difference, Trout Unlimited is a great place to do that as well. As for us, you can find this episode on the OutdoorAdventureSeries.com. That's our webpage. You can like, comment, and share episodes there. You can also find us on LinkedIn and Facebook at Outdoor Adventure Series, the pages. And we are on all of the podcast directories. So wherever you get your podcasts, just search for Outdoor Adventure Series and you will find us. Okay, folks, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, go out there, have a phenomenal day, and we will see you on a future episode of the Outdoor Adventure Series podcast. Take care now.